The Federal Reserve Wednesday announced it's raising base interest rates by 0.25%, continuing an effort to get inflation under control. That followed the seemingly sudden collapse of three U.S. lenders and the European investment bank Credit Suisse having to be taken over. It makes people ask if there is a coming crisis in the banking sector, even the economy as a whole. Today, we'll attempt answering some of those concerns with a former U.S. Treasury Department senior economist joining me in studio. I'm Rick Jackson. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. Also with us is the head of the local venture development organization, Jumpstart. We'll look into how new businesses may be impacted by changes not only in banks' lending, but in other venture capitalist endeavors as entrepreneurs seek funding and support. And what part might state and local leaders play to help startups? We'll then close with another episode of the podcast, Shuffle, talking with a young pianist known as the Other Kid from Akron, who's seen glimpses of stardom this past year, even making an appearance in a Hollywood tribute to Whitney Houston. It all starts after news. It is The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you so much for joining us today. In a news conference yesterday, the Federal Reserve announced it was raising interest rates by 0.25%, continuing its efforts to control inflation. Some monitors had been wondering whether the Fed would raise interest rates, given that three U.S. lenders have failed in the past few weeks. The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank was the largest bank failure since 2008, second largest in U.S. history. It impacted not just companies in San Francisco, but caused shutters for startups and tech companies across the country, including here in Ohio. Add in two other U.S. lenders collapsing, Signature Bank and Silvergate Bank, and then the Swiss investment bank Credit Suisse having to be taken over, there is now a growing concern about the stability of the banking sector and the economy as a whole. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell addressed these developments in a speech saying, quote, our banking system is sound and resilient, and that the Fed is prepared to use all of its tools to keep it safe and sound, though he did mention the extent of these crashes on the economy is uncertain. This hour, we're going to begin the show by talking about the state of the banking sector and how the perception of a banking crisis is impacting the economy. And joining me in studio for this conversation is Dr. Kevin Jakes, a former U.S. Treasury Department senior economist who now works as the chair of the Finance and Analytics Department at Baldwin Wallace University. You were back with the Treasury Department during the Bush administration. Thank you for sharing your expertise.
Thanks, Rick. Welcome.
Good to have you here. In a few moments, we'll add in Jumpstart CEO Ray Leach to the conversation. He'll talk about how startups in the region have been affected by the Silicon Valley Bank collapse. First, though, if you want to join the conversation, if you have questions about SVB or inflation or rising interest rates, give us a call. Toll free is 866-578-0903. Locally, 216-578-0903. You can tweet us at Sound of Ideas. You can email soi@ideastream.org. Kevin, help us non-financial experts explain why the Silicon Valley Bank collapse is so vital.
Okay, so what ends up happening is when you take banks like a Silicon Valley, like a Signature, they're very, very involved with startup companies. And so what oftentimes happens is when you have bank failures, particularly if those banks are in, they do lending in particular regions or particular industries, it can have a detrimental effect in those industries. The other problem, and here's the bigger macro problem that we would have worried about at the Treasury Department, is when you start to get bank failures like this, you see, and we saw this with Signature, we saw this with SVB in particular, we saw an old-fashioned bank run. And bank runs are contagions of fear. And so what happens is people react. You know, I would love to tell you that finance operates in this kind of, everybody makes rational financial decisions. But in truth, finance has an awful lot of psychology going. So when people see bank runs and they see what happened at a Signature, at an SVB, they say, uh-oh, those people ran to get their money out. I better run and get my money out of my bank too, even though there is FDIC insurance.
And most of us aren't going to break that cap of $250,000 that the FDIC insures, but they made the extraordinary step of saying, we'll cover you beyond that.
Well, let's put a couple things in place here. So first of all, for your average small business, for your average depositor, the $250,000, you're not going to be anywhere near the cap. So most small businesses, depositors, it's a non-issue. The FDIC has worked for decades. They are experts in how to resolve failed financial institutions with minimal disruption to the depositor. So what they'll normally do is they'll go in on a Friday, they'll close the bank, sounds a little strange, and then they'll reopen on Monday and it's business as usual. So for your average depositor, assuming they're under 250,000, the most they're going to see is maybe a temporary inconvenience in getting in writing a check or getting some money out over the weekend, but it's a non-event. It's absolutely a non-event. Now, what happens in the case of the SVB is you are in excess of 90% of the depositors were uninsured. And uninsured depositors, you should generally assume you're going to take a loss if the bank were to fail. Mm-hmm. And that's the normal procedure. But what happened in this particular case is there's what's called a systemic risk exception. And so you might think of it this way. The FDIC, the Federal Reserve, the Treasury Department, their staffs, they all get together, they look at the bank, and they say, if this bank were to fail, will it have disrupt significant adverse effect on either the financial markets as a whole or the real economy? If so, they will make a recommendation to the Treasury Secretary, we're going to use the exception to keep the bank open and guarantee all depositors. Then they go to the president. I used to work on this for Treasury back in the Bush years. And what I would say is people are reading it that going forward, Janet Yellen and the Treasury Department are going to insure all uninsured deposits. That's not true either.
Perception causes reality. You mentioned the idea of a bank run earlier where people see the money and they want to run and get theirs. What we didn't have in 2008 that we have now is the speed of social media. Twitter is getting a lot of blame for having fueled some of what happened to SVB.
I believe that's absolutely true. What I would tell people is the following. So here's something to keep in mind. One of the things I've seen too often already is people seeing the bank problems at SVB, seeing the bank problems at Signature, Credit Suisse, and saying, uh-oh, this is 2008, 2009 relived.
It's not. Why isn't it?
Why isn't it? Well, because what happens is what we see in these banks, right, that this turmoil that's going on right now, this is a function of two things. Mm-hmm. It's a function of the fact that the Fed raised interest rates really quickly, and that caused some significant losses for particular banks that did a very poor job of managing their interest rate risk. Because SVB fails, that doesn't mean the next bank and the next bank and the next bank are going to fail.
We saw some banks, local banks, regional banks, start to lose their value because people did panic. Fifth Third, Key Bank.
Right, the fear and the panic. And this is why I say they're different. In 2008, 2009, it was what we call a credit risk problem. So bank number one fails. And the fact that bank number one failed because of, say, mortgage-backed securities or mortgages, that meant that impacted the ability of bank number two to do business, which impacted bank number three and four. And now all of a sudden, it looks like one of those games of dominoes you saw kids mm-hmm. used to play. That's a very different situation. The problems we see going on right now are idiosyncratic to the banks themselves. It's particular to the bank and the fact that they had bad risk management and had lots of insured deposits. But you have lots of banks out there. They have plenty of capital. They know how to manage their risk. Regulators look at that all the time. They know how to manage their risk. When they see interest rates rise like they did, they say, okay, look, we've got to make adjustments. And they did.
Well, if regulators are watching, they're supposed to be monitoring financial risk. How did this happen that nobody saw it coming and suddenly we have three banks going belly up?
Yeah, this is one of the criticisms, and that is in the perfect world, what happens is regulators regulators are in these banks. They make on-site examinations periodically. They get quarterly call report data, financial information on the bank, and there's some assessment you can do. So they're monitoring banks on-site, they're monitoring banks off-site. So what ends up happening is if the way the system is designed, if regulators begin to see problems, then they make the banks aware and they say to the banks, hey, guess what? We're seeing some problems in this, that, or the other particular area. So things like, do you have enough capital? Capital is the bank term for equity. And capital is designed to absorb unexpected losses. Does your management know what it's doing? Do you have high-quality management in place that know how to manage particular problems and particular issues? So regulators are assessing this stuff all the time. And so what appears happened in this particular case is regulators began to put the bank on notice to say, hey, wait a minute, interest rates have risen really, really fast. We don't necessarily like what we're seeing going on here. You need to make adjustments. Not clear that the bank made enough adjustments, number one. And number two, with that many uninsured depositors. So should a bank fail, the uninsured depositors are not covered by the FDIC.
Right.
So uninsured depositors see things starting to go really wrong, and they say, I got to get out. And so what precipitates these bank runs is large depositors all of a sudden pulling their money and getting out as fast as they can. And social media simply makes this kind of rumor mongering or this kind of on your phone, I'm going to undertake a transaction, easier and quicker than ever before.
Perception becomes reality. Thanks. Let's bring Jumpstart CEO Ray Leach into the conversation. Now he's joining us by telephone. Ray, good to talk to you again.
Good morning, Rick. Great to be with you.
Let's talk about how the Silicon Valley Bank collapse in particular impacted the Ohio startup scene.
I think your listeners will be very interested in knowing that dozens of organizations, probably 30 to 40 startups across Ohio, and some of our largest startups in Cleveland and across Ohio were directly impacted by SVB's collapse.
How so? What, did they have money in there directly, or what led to their issues?
Absolutely. So they all had money in SVB directly and as a depositor. But I think another important element for folks to understand is if you're a very, very small startup in Cleveland or in Ohio, you probably do not have a relationship with an entity like Silicon Valley Bank. But as you are raising more and more capital and growing and scaling your business, there's a significant likelihood you're going to create a partnership or a relationship with Silicon Valley Bank, not only because of the moniker or maybe the reputation of the bank, but they also provided products and services specifically tailored to startups that attract in startups across the United States to bank with SVB.
As we saw Washington take extraordinary steps to back the money that was there, was everybody in Ohio made whole?
They were, and by the way, it was a remarkable weekend. There's many stories out, and certainly Jumpstart Ventures has its own stories around what that weekend was like. And again, since these startups, the ones that are banking with them are typically the larger ones, they'd have millions or tens of millions of dollars of deposits with SVB that they needed to gain access to make payroll. And so, yes, it was very much an all hands on deck weekend. For Jumpstart and venture investors and, of course, startups across Ohio and the entire Midwest. So this isn't just a coastal thing.
Right. Just before this program, during Marketplace, we were hearing about the problems for crypto because the banks they were working with were among those that failed. Were there impacts on the local business scene, some of the businesses here that might have been dealing with crypto, or do we not see that as much in Northeast Ohio?
Yeah, I think the Midwest isn't as significant of an adopter of cryptocurrency in general, let alone with tech startups. So that hasn't been the kind of issue in the Midwest and Ohio and Cleveland as the SVB collapse and Signature Bank's collapse was.
I understand, Ray, that you've been spending time talking to state leaders, to local leaders, trying to bring them up to speed on how the recent collapses do impact our local startups. Are they grasping it? Are they receptive to the suggestions you may have?
Absolutely. And I've been very impressed by our leaders in Washington as well and their level of engagement over the weekend where this all transpired. So the ability to interconnect legislators, political leaders, community leaders to the proximity. I mean, many Ohioans, Clevelanders might not realize startups in Ohio employ tens of thousands of our residents, and they have a huge, not only direct but indirect impact on our economy. So I've been very encouraged by the proximity and the interest and the level of energy that was expended over that weekend, not just for folks like us, but for our country's leaders.
Sure. Kevin, as a financial analyst, jump in here. What impact do you think these collapses would have on startups here and everywhere?
Well, here's the bigger question we would have concerned ourselves with. And Treasury and the Federal Reserve and the FDIC clearly looked at this. So let me go back to a comment I made earlier. When you have, when the FDIC, the Treasury, they make this systemic risk exception. And so what's happened is the Federal Reserve, with all of their macro economists looking at the macro economy, getting feedback from the regional banks, and there's a regional Fed office right here in Cleveland, what they're doing is they're taking a look and they're looking across the country and they're saying, is this problem with the banks and the current turmoil, is that going to cause our financial markets to go to become significantly disrupted and adversely affected? If so, now all of a sudden it's going to be harder for businesses to get loans. And as Ray knows, a lot of times smaller businesses are deemed to be riskier. And because of that, it's already difficult enough for startups and small businesses to get loans. They need to expand their business. So the government took a peek at this, the policymakers, the Treasury, and they said, wait a minute, we are concerned about disruption either to the financial markets or directly to the real economy. So what they're saying is, hey, guess what? This is going to hit startups. This is going to hit small businesses right in the pocket. So they said, we're going to guarantee all those uninsured deposits because we recognize that there is a problem here that may spill over. And small businesses and startups are just one of the places it could spill over and negatively impact.
866-578-0903 if you have questions, or SOI at ideastream.org if you have a comment you'd like to make that way. Kevin, a former bank examiner in Akron, he says it's with the Office of Thrift Supervision, saying that you are nailing it spot on here, and that, you know, other other folks need to be listening to what you're saying here, because we have seen so much turmoil. Ray, would you like legislators to have been in on this conversation, listen to the concerns about venture capital investment across our state?
Absolutely, and I have to share with the listeners that I've been incredibly impressed by the understanding and the proximity and the urgency that our legislators at the local, regional, state, and federal level have had. It has been an encouragement to me, given that venture capital or the advancement of young tech companies hasn't always been something that some of our leaders have understood, I think, to the degree they do today.
Thanks for that. Do we need to have tighter regulations, Kevin, for the banks?
People are going to think this sounds funny coming from me, but no, it's not a problem of regulation. So let me step back to a conversation that has clearly been occurring in the media recently, and that is, in the previous presidential administration, there was a weakening of some bank regulations.
An email on that point too, so go ahead.
Okay, so one of the questions was, if the Trump administration had not weakened some of those bank regulations, would that have prevented this crisis? And the answer is probably no, but I want to preface that. So what that regulation did is it took one tool out of the toolkit. So bank regulators have a whole bunch of tools that they use. And so this simply took one tool out of the kit. Now, at the end of the day, if bank examiners are in the bank doing what they're supposed to do, the bank is operating and managing its risks well, maintaining its capital, maintaining its asset quality, all the things examiners and the regulatory agents require, then you will sometimes suffer bank failures. It's not uncommon. But the answer is, in this particular case, supervision, not regulation, was not strong enough, and the bank was doing a very poor job. Banks, plural, I should say, were doing a very poor job of managing their interest rate risk. And so, another tool in the toolkit, yes, it would have helped. Would it have eliminated this turmoil? Probably not.
When you say the supervision was a little bit lax, should we be concerned that so many members of the Fed are former bank executives? They maybe don't want to slap the wrist of their friends.
No, it's not so much that. Rather, what happens, and my apologies to my friends in the banking industry, banking is one of the most heavily lobbied industries in Washington, D.C., and I'm talking at the congressional level. And so there's this constant push for deregulation. And so we've seen over the decades some of the problems that have occurred because of that. Mm-hmm. Real quick, simple story. I used to sometimes go up to hearings on Capitol Hill representing the Treasury Department. And you would have senators or members of the House of Representatives who would ask regulatory questions. And we knew the congressional members, we knew their staffs. They were fed a question by the banking industry because the lobbyists to argue it was really nothing but another way of arguing, hey, your regulation is too tight.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that. Ray, if I'm somebody who wants to start up a business now, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm thinking about coming to you, should I be nervous right now? Is this a good time to be starting from scratch?
It is a good time to start from scratch. You typically... There's lots of examples of companies who've started at a downturn or at the beginning of a downturn or in the scenario or circumstance we kind of find ourselves in overall. So, you know, if you're looking to raise, you know, $500,000, $1 million, $2 million to get going, now is a good time. What I think is connected also to your question is if you're a Midwest startup and you're looking to raise 10, 15, 20 million, you're 2, 3, 4 years down the road. That is a little bit more challenging right now in the middle part of the country. We are anticipating, because of the Silicon Valley Bank episode, that capital will likely be a little bit more constrained for larger investment rounds in the Midwest for the next year or two. So this will have an impact for companies that are further down the pike and are raising larger amounts of capital.
Thanks for that. Let's grab some of these phone calls. Linda is on the line from Lakewood. Linda, welcome to the Sound of Ideas. What's your thought for Kevin or Ray?
Everything I've heard this morning is reminiscent for me to 2008 when John McCain kept saying, actually 2007, fundamentals of the economy are strong. Fundamentals of the economy are strong until it wasn't a year later. I'm not sure there's any difference between then and now, even though you've explained there is.
Why not, Kevin Jakes?
Well, again, 2008, 2009, that was set off by the problems in the mortgage market and a banking crisis, which then rippled from one bank to another. And now all of a sudden our economy goes into a very severe 18-month recession. For today, Linda, you need to separate the two parts, and I'll say the two parts. You've got turmoil in the banking system. I said this last week, and I've been proven right already. There will be a few more bank failures. Okay, but my point is few. The vast majority of banks in this country, they're absolutely fine at managing risk, and this is not a problem that is likely to spill over one bank after another bank after another bank, and we end up in a severe recession caused by banking turmoil. On the other hand, what we have is we have a Federal Reserve which has raised interest rates from near zero a year ago to yesterday, 5% for what's called mm-hmm. the federal funds rate. And if you look historically, when the Federal Reserve goes about fighting inflation and does these dramatic increases in interest rates, it oftentimes brings the economy down, or ideally it only slows it down to drive out the inflation. But historically, there have been episodes when the Federal Reserve does this that do cause a recession. And so there's two separate issues playing out here. I don't believe the bank turmoil is going to result in a recession. It's possible, depending upon, and I've said this in other public forums, depending upon how far the Federal Reserve wants to raise that interest rate, they may or may not create a recession. Inflation does not come down quickly. I don't care, Republican president, Democratic president, Reagan this year, this decade, that inflation does not come down quickly in the face of rising interest rates.
Shoots up, spirals down.
It takes its time.
Yeah, okay.
It takes time to come down. So we are going to continue to see some issues.
Let's jump out to Lodi, where Tim is on the line. Tim, welcome.
Hello, good morning. Hey, I'm just curious how much of this is this in Peter Thiel's lap when he sent out that tweet and started that run. I don't have any like for the guy because he's my age. I'm 55, and he's got $5 billion in a Roth IRA, which makes me highly suspicious of him already.
Okay, thanks for that. Yeah, we did mention earlier that Twitter had some impact.
Yeah, and so, you know, he gets a lot of attention, and I don't know him, but when you sit there and you have a depositor and they've got huge amounts of uninsured deposits and they yank it out of the bank quickly, there's a bank run, but it's a bank run. When you've got the kind of money he's talking about, you're talking about a bank run on a scale most of us
can't
imagine.
Right.
And so you've got this massive run by one individual, and then lo and behold, it ends up on social media. And you say, hey, wait a minute. And here, this is the psychology, how psychology, not finance, is really playing in. Hey, wait a minute. Here's some guy that's got a whole lot of money. And he's racing to get his money out as fast as he can. And I saw it on social media, so I better get mine out too.
Doesn't mean he's any smarter than the rest of us.
What probably happened is he saw the forthcoming problems. He said, wait a minute, I've got massive amounts of money. I got to get it out really fast. And that actually accelerates all the problems because now the bank's in a worse position than it was before.
Last thing, an email just came in at the last second here asking if there should be some kind of punishment for the SVB executives who failed to do their jobs correctly. Donna wants to know that.
Depends on how you want to define punishment.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen nothing so far that says anything criminal was done. Okay, now having said that, what I have seen when you start to look, we saw this in the 1980s. We saw this in the mid-1990s. Interest rates take a significant increase. Bankers who manage what's called interest rate risk at the financial institutions, they take risks they should not have taken in retrospect. They should. I mean, some risks just shouldn't be taken. It's classic banking I teach in college to seniors. So part of what we're seeing here, I wouldn't call it criminal. What I would say instead is, it was really bad risk management on the part of these institutions. And obviously, the institutions did a very poor job, and some of the individuals responsible took risks they had no business taking with depositors' money.
Gotcha. Last word to Ray Leach. It's still a good time, though, you were saying, to jump in. And what's the last thing you want us to know about the local startups?
I guess what I'd say is, you know, the local startup scene is connected to the national scene. Ohio is a capital importer. So, you know, when companies begin to scale in Ohio, a lot of those dollars are coming from the coast. Those are the venture funds that are funding the growth of the businesses here in the Midwest. So all these things are interconnected. There's not, you know, regional startup ecosystems that aren't impacted by this national dimension. So we're going to be super focused on helping companies not only get through the next days and weeks, but also help to strengthen the capital and startup ecosystem and its connectivity to the coast. So this will have a significant impact for the next couple of years.
Jumpstart CEO Ray Leach, Baldwin Wallace Financial Professor Dr. Kevin Jakes, thank you both for being here today.
Thanks, Rick. Been a pleasure.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break here and then feature another film from this year's Cleveland International Film Festival. It's a horror film dealing with mental health. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thanks for being here. The Cleveland International Film Festival got underway last night at Playhouse Square. 121 feature films, 199 short films, screening over the next week and a half. Handful of those films with connections to Northeast Ohio. Dark Water is a short film premiering at the festival next week, written, produced, directed by a Northeast Ohioan who also used all local cast and crew. It's a short horror film examining one woman's mental health struggles and the force behind that film. Noni Shiverick joins me now. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, this is going to be a great conversation. And folks, if you want to join, 866-578-0903, the number to call to talk to Noni, email soi@ideastream.org. Before we get to Dark Water, though, let's talk about your path a bit. You're from the area. How'd you get interested at all in filmmaking?
Well, I've always been a storyteller. It usually got me in trouble as a kid because my stories were manifesting as whoppers usually. But I was always very creative. I was a dancer for a while, a figure skater. And my mother kept telling me, you know, you're a storyteller. You need to get into telling stories. And I got into film acting for a while. And I realized the scripts that were given to me weren't really the stories that I wanted to tell. So I started telling my own and started a production company to produce those films. And here we are today.
And here we are. Tell me about the ecosystem of filmmakers, cast, crew in Northeast Ohio. We've seen the blockbuster productions coming in recent years. Does all of that benefit smaller independent artists like yourself?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the talent pool in Cleveland is actually extremely deep. There's a vibrant local independent film community in Cleveland, Ohio. We do have an issue with talent bleeding into other cities for more opportunities, but we have a lot of really enthusiastic people here in Cleveland making movies who are extremely talented, and hopefully the more like streaming opportunities have opened doors for independent filmmakers, the increase of festivals going on around does put eyes on independent films. So I'm hoping that the Cleveland scene continues to grow.
I think we're all hopeful of that. So I don't want to give too much away about your newest project, Dark Water, but I got to admit, I woke up overnight and it was raining and that kind of scared me. But it follows one woman who's dealing with a mental health issue. She's plagued by visions, and I think we just can give away that it is water, hallucinations possibly. Where did this come from?
So I really wanted to tell a mental health story. I had a previous project that dealt with rape trauma, and I wanted to go back into telling another human issue story. And I found that almost everyone I know has experienced some form of panic attack or depressive episode. And I wanted to make a film that would encourage people to approach the issue differently or want to talk about the issue, because I think mental health still has an enormous amount of shame and stigma attached to it.
You also touch on the idea of PTSD, the specific descriptor in Dark Water, drowning, the opportunity to not breathe because of the water. Is that something you heard from people who've dealt with PTSD or some kind of anxiety?
Yes, it was. The drowning is meant to symbolize a panic attack, and I myself have had a panic attack. And having talked to other people who have experienced them, I found that something that a lot of people said they experienced was this feeling of, I can't breathe, I can't get air in my lungs. So I decided to utilize water and drowning as that's a horror element. Spoiler alert for those of you who want to watch the film. But that's how I wanted to kind of convey this sense of panic and anxiety in the world closing in.
Folks, watch the film anyway, even if we give it away. You said a big focus for you is to promote women in film, provide space for diverse voices. What's it been like being a female writer-director up to this point?
It's hard, to be honest, but empowering too. I really make an effort to build up other female filmmakers around me or up-and-coming filmmakers to mentor them. Still a lot harder for women in the industry to get our films funded, to get, you know, distribution deals on our films, to even just get our stories made. So when I founded One Eye Wild, I specifically wanted to only tell stories that were about women, written or directed by women. So far we have managed to accomplish that.
You mentioned One Eye Wild. Why start a production company? Did you just want to give opportunities to people that didn't have them when you were searching?
Well, I was tired of knocking on the door for Hollywood, and I decided to make my own content, my own projects. So I didn't want to sit around and wait for someone to give me an opportunity, because as a woman in the industry, you might be waiting a very, very long time for someone to give you an opportunity. So I decided I would create my own opportunities, and in doing so, create opportunities for other people.
Besides opportunities, besides funding, what are the biggest roadblocks to equity that you still bang up against?
It's hard because you have to, there's no guarantee that a film will make money in the box office, especially in the post-COVID ecosystem. So that's hard to meet with investors, and I'm in the process right now of being in pre-production with a feature film, so my co-producer and I are running into this. we can't, it's hard to explain, like, film is inherently a risky, it's a high risk, high reward investment, but I can't guarantee that it'll make money in the box office. A low budget horror almost always makes money in the box office, but there's absolutely no guarantee. And I think especially in today's world, people are a little bit risk adverse. So that's definitely hard to, and it's, when you're working with studios, it's hard to keep your own equity. You know, there's a lot of, so I contracted a lawyer early on years ago because I found that a lot of people would like to take your equity in your film away from you and keep the profits for themselves. Mm-hmm.
The film was shot here in Cleveland, as we said. Cast and crew is local. Aside from the obvious aspect of making something where you grew up, are there other advantages to having the production in Northeast Ohio?
Oh, yeah. I mentioned before the to make a film in Northeast Ohio, we have a really deep talent pool, a lot of super enthusiastic, talented film people that will, you know, if they really believe in the project, will jump on board wholeheartedly. It's a really deep talent pool, and the Cleveland Film Commission is super supportive of local filmmakers. Right. It's probably the only city I've lived in where I can text someone at the Cleveland Film Commission and be like, I have a question about this, and they get back to you immediately and are basically bending over backwards to help you get your project made because they want projects to be shot in Cleveland.
Wonderful. You mentioned a little bit of what's coming up, but what is on the docket for One Eye Wild? What other projects are on your plate?
Well, hopefully we are going to get our feature film funded. It is a long uphill battle, but I've been very resourceful and determined thus far to get this film done. It is set in Cleveland. It's a female-led detective thriller, which you don't see every day. And we would love to shoot it in Cleveland if we can.
Okay. Well, we wish you the best of luck, certainly.
Thank you.
Noni Shevrick's film Dark Water premieres at the Cleveland International Film Fest next Tuesday. That's the 28th. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you.
Okay, and we'll see you down there. So, time for another quick break. But on the other side, the latest episode of our music podcast, Shuffle. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson. We will be right back. It is The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for being here this hour. A young pianist, known as the Other Kid from Akron, has seen glimpses of stardom this past year, from the live stage to the big screen. On this week's Shuffle, IdeaStream Public Media's Amanda Rabinowitz caught up with Kofi B about his breakout year.
Kofi Boakye, who performs as Kofi B, was a guest on Shuffle 4 years ago. And he's been on quite a journey since then. When we talked in 2019, Kofi was already an accomplished musician, the youngest Black pianist to be enrolled at the University of Akron School of Music's jazz program. He had been to the White House to accept an Education Excellence Award, and the list goes on. It all started when he was 8 years old. His mom received an advertisement in the mail for group piano lessons. Here's what he said back in 2019.
I was going to quit that first lesson, but then the teacher pulled me aside, and her name was Trisha Thompson, and she said, "Wait, don't leave. I see something in you." She was looking at my hands, and she's like, "Your hands are just large. I see something in you," and stuff like that. And so she said, "Instead of the group lessons, let's take private lessons." And so I said, "Okay, I'll try that." The weeks that passed, I went from the beginner's books to the advanced books, and at the time I was going through a situation where my father was leaving our lives, and he was, you know, pursuing a divorce with my mother. And when he left, he didn't just leave silently. He left and, you know, told us, "Hey, you'll never be anything without me. You won't amount to anything." And so hearing that stuff at a young age, it's like, man, what do? You have two options. Either you fold and believe that mantra that he set for yourself, or you become who you believe you can be. And through music, I found that.
We left off when he was raising money to attend the prestigious Berklee College of Music in Boston. Now he's 23. Pick up from there. What happened?
At the time, it was just a dream, a pipe dream. And, you know, by fundraising and a lot of crowdfunded campaigns, I was able to raise $50,000 to go to that school.
Wow, so $50,000.
Yeah, I was able to afford that first year. And I felt like if I could get to Boston for just that first year, then I can, you know, I think get something special going on and maybe build the funding or get some more funding from the school to continue my education there. So just getting there was really cool. And then the pandemic hit.
you know, made a switch from my schooling to surviving out there, because I was still living in Boston, and I was playing at a church that afforded me a salary to be there, so I was able to pay for my rent. But then rent got a little expensive, and I realized that maybe the cost of living might be more efficient if I fly back and forth. So I moved back to Ohio.
Wow.
And I was flying 4 times a week for 6 months straight. Sleep in the airports, stay in the hotels for a night. But it was just cheaper than paying rent out there to buy a $20 flight during the pandemic. I realized I was trying to raise money to go back to Berkeley still during the pandemic. I didn't know how I was going to perform or anything like that. So my best bet was to save the money that I was earning as much as I could from playing at that church. But then something kind of happened in 2022.
Yeah. I want to back up, because before the pandemic in 2019, the Apollo first came in the picture.
Yes. Oh, the Apollo did reach out at the same time I was raising money to go to Berkeley. And, you know, at the time, I was submitting things for a number of different talent competitions. So, you know, one day I got a random email and it said, congratulations, and you've been selected to be a part of Amateur Night at the Apollo. And that started my Apollo journey.
For listeners who may not be familiar with the Apollo, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Apollo Theater is the epicenter of Black excellence for the most part. I mean, this is the place and the starting place for so many great Black American actors, musicians, artists, I mean, you name it, they came through the Apollo. It is a crowd-driven event, and their amateur nights are very, very animated. The crowd has an opportunity to let you know if they like you or not, and they can let you know immediately. If they don't like you, then there's this man called the Executioner, and he'll come on the stage and he'll take you off. The Apollo has opened the doors for so many people: Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder, Ella Fitzgerald, Whitney Houston, even modern day artists like her, Machine Gun Kelly. I mean, the list goes on and on. And now you can say my name in that, too.
So tell me about that journey in 2019, because, you know, spoiler alert, you won it. You won it in November of 2022,
yeah.
Right? But in 2019, you went pretty far in the competition.
Yeah, in 2019, I made it all the way to the final round. I brought a whole bus load of people. I was like, let me just try to see if I can win by bringing a bus of people from Akron, Ohio that support me and love me and I know will cheer for me. And that still wasn't enough.
Then what happened? How did you get back on that stage?
I went back to Berkeley for my second semester and my first year there. And then the pandemic hit. When I saw an announcement that they were returning back in 2022, and I reached back out to them and I said, is there a way I can come back and at least give it another shot? And then they had me for the opening night. That was the first night back. Nick Cannon was hosting the show. And,
wow.
You know, I just felt like this was my time.
Put your hands together and give it up for Kofi!
First place in pretty much every round except for one of them, and took home that grand prize in the end.
So you just kept going round after round, 4 rounds, and you won that grand prize, $20,000.
Yeah, I mean, it got to the point to where, I mean, I was the only instrumentalist in pretty much every round. Everybody else was like a powerhouse singer or a dancer. And
I've watched the video of the moment you've won so many times.
Well, I score 94. Put your hands together for Kofi!
What was going through your mind?
I relied heavily on my mechanics that I built up. You know, people don't understand, I think, what goes into a lot of these performances that I do. Because I'm a very detail-oriented guy. I watch hours and hours and hours of film of other performers before I'm even doing this. I kind of do this whole boot camp where I'm on I used to call it like my Apollo diet, but now it's like a lifestyle diet, constantly looking at film of other performers. I would watch Michael Jackson concerts just to watch his footwork, not to learn how to sing or entertain like him, but there's just different things that I wanted to put into my act that I wanted people to see on stage and understand, because I'm very limited with just a piano, but I wanted to be able to show people that I can still put on a show. always go to New York a couple days before. I'll rent out a piano studio for a couple hours. Every day I'm there, practice every time. You know, even though it's the same song that I play, it can never be the same way. I have to make it different every time because those Apollo rounds are very strenuous. So, and I also knew what the goal was in mind. I wanted to win, and I knew I had a really good chance to do that.
And your signature song is?
Is Say Yes by Floetry right now. Yeah, that's
the one that you've perfected. You know, that makes so much sense to me because when I watch your performances, I mean, it's captivating, it's energizing. And then I have to say, you have a stylist.
I do have a stylist.
Because that's the other thing I noticed. Like, you're up there and you look like $1 million.
Candice Caprice is an amazing stylist, and she styles everything that I wear.
What happens after you win the Apollo?
Yeah, everybody wants to know what's next in so many different instances. So what happens after I win the Apollo in a real sense is that I get a bunch of phone calls from a lot of friends that I never knew I had. That happens
yeah.
very quickly.
Yeah.
But after that, the mindset switches to how can I build what I'm doing? You know, a Whitney Houston movie started to come out, and I happened to be in that. And that was an awesome opportunity that I filmed even before I even knew I was coming back to do the Apollo. So I think the timing of everything was just so sequential.
Yeah, you were in the Whitney Houston biopic, I Want to Dance with Somebody. Give us that story. How did that come about?
So at the time, a random supporter of mine reached out or sent a message to me on Instagram, and it just said, pianist wanted for a movie. I had sent in my video of me performing at the Apollo. I got a phone call from a casting director. Are you sitting down? Are you sitting down for this? I said, no, I'm standing up, but tell me what's going on. And she said, you know, they want you for the Whitney movie. They want you. And she said, the director said she wants you for this scene. Yeah, we were able to put together a really successful day of shooting that scene. And the rest is history. I did some of the music for the movie. And I mean, a phone call like that really just changed my life.
These huge opportunities just keep coming your way.
Yeah. And you know, I think the beauty of this journey is that, you know, it's coming to me organically, but the work is still being done. There's no, you know, complacency that's come from me from any of these opportunities. I think they just push me to kind of work harder. And I'm really hungry right now to have that success just continue. I don't want to fail. I just want to continue to push and, you know, show that other kid that's watching me that everything that you're dreaming is capable of happening. I know you may play an instrument that nobody likes right now, but in 10 years, if you're still working at that thing, they're going to hear what you got to say.
I do want to talk about your mom. She's at the forefront of your entire journey, raised you as a single mom. She was there at the Apollo during the finals.
Yeah, she was.
How is she feeling about all this?
She's just, right now, she is a proud everything, you know. Not only is it just me, but I have two older brothers that are, you know, very, very, very successful in their fields of what they're doing. And just watching her, you know, better her life and then me striving to make mine even better. And especially coming from Akron, Ohio and being where I'm from, you don't see that often. You always see the inverse side of that where the whole, you know, the single parent and kids weren't this and they went to this route and they chose, you know, alcohol or drugs and all these different things that maybe hampered their successes. And I choose to just, you know, be the adverse of that as well as my two older brothers. As much as she's proud of us, I'm immoderately proud of her, you know.
I love that.
Yeah.
What's going on now? You're still going back and forth, Boston and Akron?
Yeah, I find myself more here than I do in Boston right now.
Yeah.
You know, and what I aim to do is just to continue to nail every opportunity I have and every expectation I set forth for myself in my life. There's no detailed plan. There's no detailed destination. But, you know, there is an anticipation and an expectation that I have for myself. And that's every time I do whatever I said I'm going to do, I'm going to nail it.
You always say the other kid from Akron,
mm-hmm.
the other being LeBron James.
Yeah.
No matter what happens, is Akron always going to be part of the story?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Akron is the story. It's the beginning of it, and it should be the ending of it. And I think it's the same thing if you ask LeBron. I mean, the journey comes from understanding what this city had to offer from the jump. I can't be who I am today if I didn't learn from what my hometown taught me. And let me be the person to carry that torch and consistently still show this world what kids from Akron can do. And, you know, I hope that there's another kid from Akron coming up. You know, it's not just a me thing, it's a we thing.
Well, another thing that's so interesting here is that nothing was handed to you.
I think a lot of people just see what's going on now and they think, oh, wow, he's just an overnight sensation. No, this was 10 years of hard work and consistently doing the same thing for a long, long time. So to see everything kind of coming into fruition now, and you know, I'm just getting started, but it's a pretty cool journey right now.
Kofi, congrats. It's so great to catch up with you.
I'm glad to be here. I'm so happy to be here.
I hope you'll continue to come back and keep talking with me.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks so much.
No problem.
That's Kofi B. You can find links and more at ideastream.org/shuffle. I'm Amanda Rabinowitz, IdeaStream Public Media.
Kofi B is a 23-year-old, 2-times Emmy-nominated musician, producer, and actor born and raised in Akron, Ohio. Shuffle is your backstage pass to Northeast Ohio's independent music scene. It's produced by Amanda Rabinowitz with help from Brittany Nader. You can hear new episodes Thursdays on WKSU, every other Thursday here on The Sound of Ideas, and wherever you get your podcast. Now, to get the last word on any of today's topics, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter, @SoundOfIdeas. Follow me there as well, @RickJ903. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, it's the Friday Reporters Roundtable with your host, Mike McIntyre. This week, he's joined by Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and IdeaStream reporters Abigail Botar and Connor Morris. If you missed any portion of today's program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9, 89.7 WKSU. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you again on Monday.